Blog Talk Radio.
I'd like to dedicate this song to little Junior Parker, a cousin of mine that's gone on, but we'd like to kind of carry on in his name.
Good afternoon. We got Greg on the phone.
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, how's it going?
Good, thanks. I appreciate the opportunity to be on the show.
Well, I'm glad to have you on, and I just want to give a shout-out to all veterans serving our country in the past, in the present, and in the future. Okay, we got another call online. Call, you want to announce yourself?
Hey, this is Drew. I'm calling in and listening to the show today to, you know, just to find out, you know, what veterans are going through.
Okay, yeah. Well, we got Drew back with us again today, and that's good, too. Okay, and so, Greg, tell us a bit about your affidavit. Well, you can give us some background on yourself first, and also,
sure.
Tell how people can get in contact with you, but go ahead.
Okay, sure. It's quite a bit to say. I'm a retired disabled Navy lieutenant.
Hey, go ahead. We got almost 2 hours. Say whatever it is. Get your message out. We got 2 hours. I'm going to have you on as long as you want to stay with us.
I don't know if I have 2 hours of material, but I'll try.
Okay, go ahead.
But yeah, I'm a disabled naval officer. I graduated in 1982 from the United States Naval Academy, and in 1989 I was placed on the permanent disability retired list with the Navy for, you know, a life-threatening illness, and got married a few years later, had 3 children, and as you know, as the odds are pretty high these days, I got a divorce, and that's how the story really gets started. I once sold custody in my divorce back in 2003. I had 3 minor children, 3 really young children, and I had sole custody for about 2 years, and my ex-wife, through her mother, kept hiring attorneys, you know, dragging me into court trying to get custody, which she eventually did. She eventually did after about 2 years. And so, of course, during that hearing, I had had to have child support set, and I'm also qualified to receive Social Security disability insurance payments monthly, but the judge, for some reason, he did not use my VA disability compensation award to, you know, to calculate and establishment the child support. He only went with the direct payment the children were receiving from Social Security disability, because the children, as you know, they get direct pay. If the parent, one of the parents, is disabled, they get direct pay every month from that trust of the disabled parent. So the judge in 2004, when I lost custody, right at the end of 2004, he set child support to basically just be the direct payments that Social Security was providing already directly to the children in their name. So that went well. You know, I lost custody, and that was tough to get over. And right, my ex-wife, she, you know, like many do, she claimed that she was not receiving the payments because they were going direct deposit. I guess she figured she could fool the Texas Attorney General. And apparently she did fool them, and they believed her that I was not paying my child support, my $425 a month ordered child support, which was, again, the direct payment of the Social Security. So she filed that complaint with the Attorney General, and you know, there was an alleged arrearage of over $20,000, and she took me back to court to modify the child support in 2009. And this time the judge, despite the fact that this time I even had representation, the judge used my VA disability compensation award in establishment. In other words, he said I had to pay a certain percentage of it every month to the children. And I had a gut feeling that was not legal, because I was fairly familiar with the 38 U.S.C. 5301A grants rights, federal civil rights to the veterans, disabled veterans compensation. So I knew that law, but I just didn't understand how the judge was not adhering to that law. Of course, it was not cited by my attorney. So about a year later, I started trying to figure out what had happened to me, why I was having to pay so much more child support, and, you know, even out of my VA disability comp. And I joined a group, a Yahoo group. It was called Area 5301. And I joined them in late 2010. And I just started finding out there was a lot of veterans that were having their disability taken in child support. And I was trying to learn the laws and regulations to see if this was legal. And a few of us have pursued it since 2010, and we've concluded that it's not legal what they're doing, despite the fact that they fall back on a U.S. Supreme Court ruling in 1987 called Rose versus Rose. We've actually read the case, and they don't apply the whole case as is. Plus, U.S. Congress, and you know, at the time President Reagan in 1987, he was president. He was a very pro-military president, and they would not let that stand. They did not agree with the chastising they basically got because the U.S. Congress had written extremely deficient laws that the Supreme Court justice has pointed out in the Rose case. So they immediately got to work, and in 1988, they got rid of the old Veterans Administration, and they signed into law the Department of Veteran Affairs. And that's primarily the reason they did that, was because of the Rose decision that was affected the disabled veterans and when it came to child support. And they've since repealed all the laws that were cited in that case, and they've rewritten one of the primary laws, which was 38 U.S.C. 211 at the time, and they've repealed that and rewrote 511 to include state courts, because that was one of the deficiencies that was cited in the 87 case, was that the wording of 211 didn't say state courts or any courts. It just said U.S. courts. So now it says any court. Any courts now. Another huge development was the fact that Congress was watching like a hawk the what they call apportionments. And apportionment rulings is where the veteran has to have a claim filed on his VA disability when it comes to his dependents, and that claim is called an apportionment claim because, in short, it means it's a ruling as to whether or not the dependents will be granted a portion, hence the word apportionment, where they'll be granted a portion of the veteran's disability benefits. And it's each individual disabled veteran and their dependents, they have to look at each case and make a ruling on it. And that's by law. And one of the other deficiencies cited in Rose was that there was not any real true guidelines for the states to go about, you know, applying for these apportionment claims. There was no guidance. Well, in 1998, the commissioner of the Office, Federal Office of Child Support Enforcement, Commissioner David Gray, I believe his name was, he issued a directive. It was called IM, as in India, Mike, -98-03. It's an informational memorandum. It's a federal directive. It was directed to all the Title 4D agencies in all the states and commonwealths. You know, Title 4D is the child support agency set up under the Social Security Act of 1975 for the states. And so now there is a directive. There's a directive that tells exactly the steps that the states and commonwealths are to go through whenever they have a disabled veteran, you know, with compensation in a child support hearing. So I was starting to learn all these things, and one of the group members from Texas, he had an ongoing, very contentious child support situation there in Texas. So he was digging into his file, the VA file, to see what he could gather as far as information goes, and He came across this four-page letter that was written by the Houston Regional Council from the Department of Veteran Affairs to the state of Texas. This was in 2002. That basically said, look, you know, Mr. Williams, he's not retired with the U.S. Army. Therefore, he doesn't waive a portion of military retired pay. We can't garnish this money because the state was sending all these garnishment orders to all these disabled veterans. And the Houston Regional Council was getting tired of all this paperwork, saying, look, I can't by law garnish this money. Why are you sending us all this paperwork? You know, why are you sending us all these income withholding orders? So when I studied that letter, I learned a lot, and it kind of dawned on me that veterans were not getting due process when it came to the family court hearing for child support. You know, they were not getting the ability to present whether or not they waived a portion of military retired pay in order to receive their VA disability compensation. And that's something that you have to do, because under 42 U.S.C. Section 659, that's the garnishment code, U.S. code, and it tells in there if the disabled veteran does not waive a portion of military retired pay, then by definition his VA disability is not remuneration for employment, and therefore he has certain civil rights, one being he can't garnish it. And getting back to IM 9803, that was the first part of IM 9803, was it described, you know, 42 U.S.C. Section 659, which we just went over, talks about whether or not the money is remuneration or not remuneration for employment. And then the second half of IM 9803 was the directive, federal directive, that gave specific steps for the states to, the states' Title 4D agencies to submit an apportionment claim. Whenever you can't garnish the money, then the only jurisdiction then over that money is whether or not the Secretary of the Department of Veteran Affairs makes a ruling that the children, the dependents, are entitled to a portion of the VA disability comp. It's not up to the states anymore. The states have no jurisdiction. They have no subject matter jurisdiction over whether or not they can set the child support. Yes. Yes, that's the law. If you read 38 U.S.C. Section 511, which replaced the repealed 211, that's the new law post the 1987 Rose case, and that was written. That became law, U.S. Code in 1991, and it says that once the secretary makes a decision on the provisions of benefits for veterans and their dependents, you know, a la an apportionment ruling, then his decision is final and conclusive in that no other official or any court has any say-so in it. And I don't know how it couldn't be more clear that the states have absolutely no jurisdiction over the money. Once they are afforded the ability to define whether or not it's remuneration for employment or not. And, of course, the states still hold on to the fact that, well, we have Rose versus Rose, and we can take the money, so we do. But, you know, they're holding. It's like they're holding on to Dred Scott. You know, nobody cites Dred Scott because, you know, that's not the way it is anymore, not in this country.
Ancient history. Now, how much
exactly
power did you have? Okay, I know the states want to do whatever it is they want to do to go after people and to get money. How did the military feel about it? Whose side can you sort of see the military they're taking on this? Or what's their take on what the states are doing?
Well, in my example, I'm a Chapter 61 under Title 10, permanently disabled. In other words, I'm retired with U.S. Navy because I have a percentage disability. The other option is that you can retire with at least 20 years or more. So, given that, in my case, what's happened is the state of Texas has sent at least 10 to 12 income withholding orders to DFAS, which is the Department of Defense. That's their finance and accounting services, DFAS, and that's where they would, if I had retired military pay, which I do not, then they would garnish the money there. And so we've come across a couple of examples where the veterans are permanently disabled and they have a percentage disability, and therefore they're not supposed to be garnished, but DFAS has gone ahead and said, back to the individual Veteran Affairs Regional Office, because the VA has to call in to DFAS to find out whether or not the veteran waives a portion, you know, of military retired pay to get their VA pay. That's how VA finds out. They call DFAS. And sometimes DFAS incorrectly tells the VA, yeah, he's waiving a portion of military retired pay, when that's not the case. And subsequently, I've run across a couple of veterans who have had their VA disability illegally garnished, despite 42 U.S.C. Section 659 and the corresponding Code of Federal Regulations 5 CFR 581.103, paragraph C, paragraph 7, which clearly states that if the veteran doesn't waive a portion of military retired pay, you cannot garnish it. So
now,
tell
me this. I'm an advocate member of the Child Support Hustle, and one of our major missions is to educate and bring awareness about the reasons why child support is unconstitutional. What is the military doing to educate the veterans on what their real rights are when the states are actually overstepping their boundaries?
Well, there is no education. You know, they don't warn the troops or sailors or anything about all this. Which is, I just had a guy sign up today. He's active duty Army, and he was getting an eyeful reading all the information. He goes, "Wow, I didn't know all this was going on for all the disabled veterans." I said, "Yeah." I said, "You know, even though you're active duty, it doesn't hurt for you to go ahead and learn this information, because, you know, unfortunately, the odds are you may be one of these veterans. You may become disabled, and you may become divorced with child support." And on the other side, you know, he can reach out to all these other active duty buddies and tell them, you know, "Hey, did you know this? Did you know that they're doing this to disabled veterans?" So it's, you know, that's part of the reason that I have the group that I have at Facebook. It's called the Disabled Vet Child Support Info Group on Facebook, and I have that primarily to educate people. But the biggest reason I have that group is because I have the Parsons Due Process Affidavit, as I was describing previously, with that 2002 Houston Regional Council letter to the state of Texas. I knew that veterans were not getting due process in court, so therefore I devised an affidavit. I just call it the Parsons Due Process Affidavit, the PDPA. It basically lays down all the federal civil rights that the disabled veteran has when it comes to child support. And currently I have over 700 members, and that's a lot of disabled veterans on Facebook.
Absolutely.
that are not having their due process.
That's
they're not getting
the
equal protection.
Yeah, just think about all the ones that's not standing up. Just like, I hate to see a lot of homeless veterans, you know, somebody needs to stand up. There's no way these people should serve their country, then come back and they can't even get a roof over their head. Go ahead and comment on that. Give me your comment on that before I ask you this next question.
Well, you had said homeless. You had brought up the homeless. Yeah, you brought up the homeless, and I was just going to add that I believe it was in 2010, the American Bar Association and the Office of Child Support Enforcement and the Veterans Administration, Department of Veteran Affairs, they all three got together and they did some studies on homelessness. And one of the things that they found was that child support for these disabled veterans was one of the reasons they were homeless, because the states were taking so much of their money that Congress intended for them to have to live, you know, to have money for rent or a house. But the states were taking a big percentage of it. in these child support hearings.
So what it looks like the state, no matter if you're a veteran or a civilian, you know, they're violating people's civil rights across the board.
Absolutely. We have a good friend of mine, I was telling you, I've been studying since 2010 in the original group that I was in. His name is Jan Iannucci. He's up in the Detroit, Michigan area, and he currently he has a federal civil rights lawsuit against the governor of Michigan, the attorney general of Michigan, state of Michigan, and several attorneys who have illegally, we feel, has illegally convicted him of felony non-support, even though this, and that's despite the fact that he has a Department of Veteran Affairs special apportionment denial claim ruling. It says plainly in the ruling that no portion is to go to his children, to his dependents, because it would create a hardship, just like the Code of Federal Regulations states. If that's the ruling, that's the ruling.
So under that ruling, do the father, is the father allowed to select how much he actually want to give, or is it more from a voluntary point of view?
What it means, you know, when you do the apportionment claim, both the non-custodial and the custodial parent gets to submit what kind of financial resources they have and all the expenses. You know, they want, the VA wants to look at proof of, you know, are you visiting the child? Are you spending time with the child? Which means that, of course, if you're visiting the child, if you don't have custody of the child, like so many of these non-custodial disabled veterans, you have to have money, of course, to travel and see them. You know, you get to have them. Have them over. You got to feed them. You may have to buy them some clothes. You know, there are expenses. So the VA looks at that during the apportionment claim. You get to submit, the veteran gets to submit all the evidence that, yes, you know, I pay this much when I see my child. And, you know, included in that are attorney fees. I mean, let's face it.
Absolutely.
All these attorney fees are by far the biggest expense we have as disabled veterans. If we have these child support hearings every 3 years or so, it gets to be expensive. And, of course, the reason you're having to spend all that money on attorney is because you have a child, by definition. So that goes to child support. So the VA looks at that and says, yeah, that's an expense.
Uh-huh. Yes, it is. And think about what there's no equal protection either. You know, if the person with the child in that custody, they're going to be backed up by state money, and they can keep filing and filing and filing and keep bringing you back into court, and they'll make you spend all your money trying to defend yourself from being stripped of everything you got.
That is correct. That is my experience. And it's not only my experience. It's many veterans that I know have had very similar experiences.
Yeah, and that's the bad thing about it. And here in Alabama, I know there's been a couple of cases where the person gets there and they will only let them get a court-appointed lawyer one time in the whole entire case. After that, they'll be like, well, you already used a lawyer. It should be every time I have to come before you, I'm eligible for equal protection under the law. Why do you have to give me a limited minute of time that I can come and use a lawyer,
right. But
you got all the money in the world to hound me down anytime you want to send me some papers?
Which is the reason I came up with the PDPA, the Parsons Due Process Affidavit. That's why I came up with it, was because basically with this affidavit, it asserts all your rights. And you really don't need an attorney, at least not on the money side of it. You don't need an attorney because these attorneys were not telling the judges all these due process rights that the veteran has anyway. They were just mum, you know. They just said, yeah, we can take your money. We'll take it.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, hold on one second. We got a caller. Let's see. We got a caller. Caller, you're on the line with Greg Parsons.
Yes, that must be me, Roger Southfield.
Oh, hey, how's it going?
Hey, I just...
Good, Roger.
Just came in. I just want to hear what was going on. I know there's a big discussion tomorrow, but, again, I wanted to let you know about a few more things that we're all getting going on together right now. It's really exciting.
Yeah, yes, it is. It really is. It really is. I want to thank you for calling in. Roger, could you tell Greg something about yourself real quick? I know that they just passed, this might not be on another subject, but I know Greg's concerned about all veterans.
Yes.
They're passing, yeah, the Senate is passing this thing where veterans will have access to medicinal cannabis. So I would just introduce you. Roger worked with a lot of groups that's trying to help veterans and everybody else in the States. We should have free access. But today, Roger, we're talking about this affidavit that we come up with. We're trying to help veterans keep all their money. They need access to whatever medically that can help them. And we've had some veterans here in Alabama that served their country and lost everything they had just because they were treating their post-traumatic stress disorder with cannabis, stripped of everything they had. And they wasn't sellers, weren't dealers. They were just treating. They didn't want all the medication. But that's on another story. Roger, you want to say something before Greg tells us about his affidavit?
Yes, again, Greg, I want to thank you again for thinking about our veterans. That's the most important people I think we need to think about today, because we wouldn't have a free country today to be practicing what we're trying to practice now.
Well, I agree with you, especially on this Memorial Day weekend, Roger.
And I owe it all to my veterans to give us this chance, and I think they want us to unite and become a government ourselves to show we're responsible to the rest of our government that we can become a part of them.
Exactly.
Okay. Yeah, that's exactly right. If any of our listeners back there catch tomorrow's show, they'll be on. Roger will be on United Voices with Sherry Indiana, a show that's on this network on Sundays, and I think that their topic is what we're just not talking about. But Roger, you hanging there with us if you want to, and you can chime in when we get a break in between Greg talking. But right now, Greg is going to tell us about his affidavit.
Greg, please, I'm all ears.
Okay, well, I came up with the Parsons Due Process affidavit for these disabled veterans that have child support legal situations. I came up with it a couple of years ago, and it stems from the 2002 Houston Regional Council letter that was written. It was found in a buddy's file, child support file there in the VA. So anyway, it just lays down all the civil rights that the disabled veteran has. And, you know, to really go over it, it may be kind of really technical and boring to be on a radio, but it's typically it covers about 12 points. One of the things that it stresses that also applies to some of the other non-veteran child support non-custodials is a code of regulations called 45 CFR section 302.56. And basically that's just a federal civil right that all non-custodial parents have if they have evidence when they go into either a judicial or administrative proceeding, if they have evidence that can rebut the state guidelines, state statutes, when it comes to child support establishment, then they are to be afforded the right to rebut that. And that's the whole basis for mine, because as a disabled veteran, we have a federal directive that tells the child support agencies what they're supposed to do, right? And as I'm referring back to IM 9803, you know, when it's defined, when their disability is defined, not remuneration for employment. So somebody, you might take a note and take a look at that and see if you can come up with anything as far as rebutting if you're a non-veteran. That's a nice little federal right everyone has.
Greg, tell me this. I'm actually a military brat. My father served 37 years in the U.S. Army, and I knew how we grew up. You know, we had a household where we didn't need for anything, but it was working middle class.
Of course.
When the state is giving me, submitting these child support garnishments, as a veteran that's no longer active in the military, is it garnishing 20% of the wages or 50% of the wages? Share that with us.
Well, I mean, that's why they have Congress has passed 42 U.S.C. Section 659. It's to prevent garnishment from these disabled veterans when they do not waive a portion of retired military pay, and it's extremely rare nowadays. Whenever a veteran has served, you know, over 20 years or more, and actually has to waive a portion of their military retire pay in order to get their corresponding 100% disabled disability with the Veterans Affairs. So it's very rare. So, yeah, that's why 42 U.S.C. Section 659 is written, is to prevent that. But I know cases where the veterans, like I said, I know a couple of cases where the veteran Department of Veterans Affairs is illegally garnishing their money, despite that U.S. code.
So they're violating their own laws.
Fortunately, one of the veterans I know, he's currently filing a lawsuit against the Department of Veterans Affairs, as well he should.
So have you ever been to, approach the military and say, hey, you guys need to provide more education for veterans who are, you know, retiring or processing out of the military, and to sort of support that of what they need to know on their way out? Because it is an adjustment once you get out of the military anyway back into civilian life, but to be basically blindsided by child support orders, that definitely could be devastating.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, trust me, you know, not only myself, but other disabled veterans I'm aware of have personally written the military. They've written the Secretary of Department of Veteran Affairs. They've written the state legislators. They've written the Office of Child Support, the Federal Office of Child Support Enforcement. And, you know, nobody cares. They just keep saying, hey, it's not our prerogative. This is a state issue, civil rights issue. So what we've learned is that we have to go into a high court, be it federal or state, and we have to win a case against Rose, and we currently have a couple of those cases pending. We have a federal case pending.
How many disabled veterans do you believe this is impacting?
From what I've heard, it's the majority. It's the rule. It's not the exception.
Okay, and I know you know more about this than I do. What about, tell us about VA disability, and I know that it can't be used as an asset in a divorce. Did you get any protection under the Uniform Services Former Spouses Protection Act?
Right, that's another thing that's not being allowed to be, you know, discussed as far as due process goes, because that's one of the first things that the state is supposed to determine, you know, what your Title X status is with the military. They have to define what's disposable military retired pay and what's not. And so under USPA, the Title X USC Section 1408, that's all defined. And that's another thing that the state courts are not allowing in their hearings. They just breeze right over it and just say, when you go in, they just say, you're a disabled vet, okay, we can take your money. That's their due process. That's all the due process they get.
The state is, man.
Yeah, it just seems like to me that as far as everything else going on with veterans, as far as housing and getting the proper medicines you need and health care and seeing a doctor in a timely manner, it seems like they also want to break you financially as well.
Well, it's as if they've declared war, you know, especially the family court attorneys, the associations, it's as if they've declared war on us.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what this is. It's a war being declared on not only the family, but with it being no gender bias, it's been a war declared on father.
Right. So I will come out and say, you know, that all these family attorneys, the majority of them, they're domestic enemies of the country. You know, and veterans they take an oath to support and defend against domestic enemies. So,
and how long did you fight this in court?
Well, we're always fighting it in court, and we have, like I said, we have the federal lawsuit pending. It's in its fifth month now, and the federal magistrate has yet to dismiss the governor of Michigan or the attorney general or the state of Michigan. They haven't been dismissed yet, which is, that's very hard to do. It's very hard to sue the state.
The state has criminalized all non-custodial parents.
Yes.
Just bottom line.
I agree. I agree with that. They've declared war, you know, basically are a silent weapon for a quiet war. They don't allow the children to have a father, you know. They get very limited time with them.
Exactly. And I'll tell you another thing that we talked about this on a previous show. When you go into that child support hearing, that judge does not want to hear anything about your parental rights as far as visitation and things that matter in a child's life, like their spirituality, like their social coming up, who their friends are, what courses to take during school, and which routes. You have nothing else. You become totally financial to the courts. They don't even want your presence. And it's been some judges who actually think that it's dangerous for a father to have contact with that kid once he's out. They don't want him back in the picture, period.
Of course, they want, you know, so many of these children, you know, when they grow up, they have problems. They have mental issues. They, you know, that's all stems from the fact that they didn't have their father time to train them,
yes,
and teach them what's going on in the world.
Okay, we're going to take a quick, well, it's not a quick break. We're going to take a little quick, small, short break. When we come back, Greg, I want you to tell us all the avenues that people can contact you, and we'll continue this the discussion on the other side of this
all
break.
All right, thanks. All right.
I didn't see your name.
To the children and families. It's a pleasure, ladies and gentlemen, to introduce to you Ms. Carol Rose.
Thank you. My purpose today is not to dazzle you with my oratorical brilliance and skills. I merely want to say that I came to the 37th Circuit Family Court to make a difference. I was well qualified and hoped to be able to help Michigan families of divorce and separation, but early on I realized that the system was not designed to be child-friendly. No friendship nor honest conciliation were ever allowed in the family justice system between caseworkers and clients. It was all about money. How to get the federal and state tax dollars that were allotted each case for enforcement. In fact, our director would say regularly, we aren't the friend of the family, we're the friend of the court. We stumbled over ourselves trying to get more Title IV-D cases on our records and to increase the child support orders because the federal government granted huge allotments for each case we enforced. In the years I worked in the system, I witnessed regular deception to clients that was mandated by office policy. I saw gender bias and discrimination. I saw records destroyed. I saw office policies and rules change from week to week for the profit of the agency. I saw hundreds of pleas for parenting time or enforcement get buried because there is no money in enforcing custody or visitation issues. Increasing the child support money that came into our offices was the goal for each of us. We were rated according to how much money we brought in through asset seizures, income garnishment, court hearings, warrant issue. We wrote the orders and then we enforced them. The judge merely rubber stamped our efforts. My director proudly told me that the Child Support Enforcement Agency was the darling of the circuit court and that we actually made money for the judge and the court. Unlike the sheriff's department and so many others, our county or state was not an exception to the rule. We were one of the most successful counties, and we shared training with other counties and states so they could learn how to maximize their efforts toward increased collection. We were not only told to withhold information, forms, policies, laws, and statutes from our clients with questions, but we were forbidden to help them obtain legal relief from unfair situations beyond their control. We were instructed to quickly help those who were demanding increases in child support, but we were threatened with losing our jobs if we should breathe a word to encourage an injured or unemployed payer to petition for a reduction of any kind. For the years that I worked in the system, I put my job on the line whenever I helped any of the parties in trouble. We were not to get personally involved. Children or parents, we had nothing to do with that. I was derisively accused of wasting my time being a social worker. We worked closely with Child Protective Services and Family Independence Agencies, and they were the same way. No one wanted to improve services or hear about abuses within the system. because every worker in these huge bureaucracies is trying to keep his or her job by covering up any errors or problems. I had 6 secretaries underneath me, unlimited power in my 401k in my office to lose if I should rock the boat. But rock the boat I did when I wrote the book Friend of the Court, Enemy of the Family. Families that were bleeding from the pain of divorce and separation were insulted, tricked, lied to, and deceived by persons without adequate training to be making those kind of judgment calls. Most of the custody determinations were made by unwed, childless individuals who were totally unqualified to hold the lives of so many in their hands. The determinations were made on the basis of the most child support that could be ordered for each case.
Yeah.
Fathers or non-custodial parents were stereotyped as payers only. The court and most caseworkers felt that fathers were unnecessary and possibly dangerous for the children to have contact with. The child support system is an adversarial system. It encourages parental alienation and court battles. Children are pawns in an expensive and elaborate game of winner versus loser. Attorneys coming into the picture further divide the already fractured family and insulate the parents from communicating with each other. Usually after attorneys and agencies become involved, new and creative charges of abuse, neglect, and addiction enter the picture. Many times, these are convenient charges against innocent family members, guilty of parents, even after the partner left. I heard many unwed fathers tell me that they begged the mothers of their children to marry them, but that the mothers were unwilling to give up the welfare check in exchange for a husband and father in the home. The most outdated picture of the father leaving the mom and kids to run off with his secretary is all but a thing of the past. In Southwest Michigan, 98% of the divorces are initiated by mothers and unwanted by the father. These aren't abusive fathers either. Equal parenting is not a men's issue. I was a single mother for most of my children's lives, and I know what children need most is the love and balance two fit parents can give them. Money can never make up for the loss of a parent. Divorce or separation should not be the reason some kids will never get to know one important part of themselves. Equal parenting does not do away with child support. Child support takes on a whole new dimension for children with two loving parents instead of just one. I am humble as I stand in the shadows of one of our greatest founding fathers. Here in this place, another great father, Martin Luther King, announced to the world that he had a dream. Well, Mahatma Gandhi told us that we must be the change that we want to see in the world. Are you willing to be that kind of change? Yeah. Thomas Jefferson said that we only have the rights we're willing to fight for. Our Constitution gives all the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But for some children, the right to have two loving and involved parents in their lives has been usurped by the courts. Courts rule according to precedent, and the precedent has been biased against one parent in the past, branding him or her the non-custodial parent, which in itself is an insult. Equal parenting by two fit and willing parents is what our courts and agencies must go back to believing in. Laws and fiscal policies must not facilitate conflict and adversarial relationships between parents. It's only a matter of time before the civil rights of families will be restored in the courtrooms of our nation. Thank you.
No conversation.
Thank you, Carol. Okay, we're back with the Child Support Hustle Show. We've been talking with Greg Parsons. Greg is an advocate for disabled veterans and their due process civil rights regarding their legal child support obligations. Okay, we're back from the break, and before we go any further, I want Greg to let our listeners know any way that they can help his cause, how they can reach him, Facebook, Twitter, however it is, so they can keep in touch with him. Okay, Greg.
Well, I appreciate it. Right now, the only web presence that I have is in my Facebook group, and the group that I have is called Disabled Vet Child Support Info, and currently that's the only way that you can really reach me. Currently have about 740 members, and okay. I haven't had it established quite a year yet. I think in June sometime is the first year anniversary coming up.
Yeah, that's congratulations on that. That's a lot of people to get together, though. Each one telling another person it's going to grow. It's going to grow because I had no idea the issue was as bad as it is.
Slowly but surely the word's getting out there. Unfortunately, it's only on Facebook right now. I was trying to get another website established, but I haven't been able to finish that up.
Okay, well, maybe we can work out something with our network, because I would love to do something with veterans, and we can start from that point right there and get the message out on all their needs.
Well, I appreciate it. Maybe you can house the Parsons Due Process affidavit. I have a Microsoft Word template, and what I do is I have that in the group, and I direct all the new members to read it over and to write their due process affidavit. And it's
okay,
a template,
well,
so all they have to do is change.
We'll make sure that affidavit gets on HuntsvilleBlack.com, and we'll blast it out to several thousand people. Just send me that, and I'll make sure within 24 hours
okay. We'll
have it up. We'll definitely
all right,
spread
I appreciate
it around.
I appreciate that. But
okay,
of course,
us,
you know. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Now, go ahead.
I was just going to say, of course, you know that when we're talking about disabled vets and child support hearings, we're talking about a very, very small percentage of the population, but it's an important population.
Yes, that's exactly why I said we can start from right there and address all their issues. You know, if we don't talk about, let's just do something with veterans, you know, the child support, the homelessness we were just talking about, and we can talk about what we just had the caller call in. We can talk also about veterans being able to get some medications that they just now are proven through the Senate that they can have access to medical cannabis. But we can address a lot of veteran issues, and the child support is just one, just like the medical part of it is, and let's just come together and do something with veterans. But tell
right.
us anything else you want to tell us that stands out in your mind about what's going on with veterans and their benefits. It seems like that federal law would trump state law.
Well, of course it does, but you know, like I said, the states are holding on dearly to the 1987 Supreme Court ruling of Rose, when in fact, if they were to read all of Rose, it clearly states that even in 1987, the late Associate Justice Antonin Scalia said the question of apportionments is not before the court in this particular matter. So the apportionment question has yet to be answered. It's not in Rose, because the veteran, his name was Charlie Rose there in Tennessee. He knew about apportionment rulings back in the 80s, and he said, you know, you guys are supposed to apportion my money. But, of course, the old Veterans Administration, they probably got his claim and threw it in the trash, and he was never afforded his claim, his apportionment claim. So that was one of the reasons that President Reagan and Congress was so upset with the ruling that was handed down in 1987 against the disabled veterans. And that's why they got rid of, they immediately got rid of the Veterans Administration. Within a year, it was gone. They voted in the Department of Veteran Affairs.
Okay, you said there's a small percentage of veterans. Maybe that's why, you know, the eye is really not on it as hard as it should be. But
well,
they should be
no. I'm saying what I'm saying is
like
that.
Them.
Yeah. Well, what I'm saying is that the disabled veterans, in terms of the population, is a very small percentage. But in terms of all these disabled veterans who have to go into child support hearings, proceedings, the vast majority of them don't even know that they're having their money stolen, that they're not even having their rights presented by their attorneys to the courts. They're totally being denied equal protection under the law. The 14th Amendment is just being run over, trampled. It's just defaulted on.
Yeah, and you throw in those Title IV defunding, and then you get a state-appointed attorney who works in the same office with these people, you're really in trouble.
That's correct. I call it the modus operandi is 42 U.S.C. Section 658 Alpha. That's the incentive money that these states are getting. That's why they're doing it. And they also, of course, in Section 655, they get get two-thirds of the fee. The federal government sends them two-thirds of the cost of the fee, even more money.
Yeah.
It's millions. Yeah, it's millions of dollars in Texas.
Yeah, it is all across the country, and the majority of the people owing this don't actually owe the most to the parent. They owe the most to the state, who's hitting it with that 12 to 15% every 30 days.
Yes. Yeah, they love to build up those alleged arrearage.
It's a hamster wheel, nothing but a hamster wheel.
Well,
okay,
Greg, if
you
right now, Greg, I want to let you know you have my 100% support, and you can use my page anytime.
Anytime.
I appreciate it.
Again, I think we've got something going, and again, with I'm trying to promote a compassionate care center, there is room for a vet there.
Very good. I know that's one of the issues that's on the hot burner right now is the medicinal marijuana. I know that's a hot topic.
Okay, Roger, what's going on out there in Texas that you know of that could be working that could help veterans out there as far as the medical cannabis? Do you know, have any news out from Texas and what they're doing for their veterans out there?
No, I don't. Again, I have some great news that I'd like to announce, that Mexico City is now offering to come help to Mexico City to show Mexico City how we can work together with our two countries. And again, that could bring in our vets too, I think.
Okay. Well, we're getting some progress going on there. Okay. Greg, do you want to say anything else up to wrap the show up?
No, I appreciate the opportunity to come on and tell everybody, all the listeners, about the Parsons Due Process Affidavit. And again, if they want to get in touch, you know, you've offered your assistance there on your end. But if they're on Facebook, they can go to the Disabled Vet Child Support Info Group, and that's where they can actually see an actual, you know, due process affidavit.
Yes, and they can also go to find more information on other matters because veterans have kids, they have family members, and everything else. They also can go to the childsupporthubble.com and learn more about this system and how it's working and how we need to change it. You can also get Child Support Hustle Show on Facebook. And so with that being said, I'm going to play a study. It was a breakthrough study about how child support orders are multiplied and how they add it up and how it's illegal and very wrong how they do it. It's mainly talking about the price of taking care of a child. They come in and they put this big stipulation on you, and then they can always go back and modify up. They're never going to go in and modify down. But it talks about how the child support should be very low while the children are young, because there are mothers out here, and I know two or three, that are getting $800 and $900 a month for a nine-month-old baby. There's no baby or kid that little using all that money, and it's just terrible how they add it. The money should start out for the actual need of a child that young.
Well, it
benefits,
you know, those
go up.
Yeah. You know, those large amounts benefit the state. You see, the state gets to show the feds,
exactly,
hey, look how much money I'm collecting for this system here, so give us the money, you know, give us our incentive money. That's why they do it.
Yeah, they're going to get... Yeah, and a lot of the custodial parents, and, you know, they should understand that for every dollar they get you in a child support case, so-called for your child and your child's best interest when they don't, because they don't come over and read your child and hug your child and comfort them when they're sick. When they give you $1, they're going to get $5 from the federal government. The state is between you and your child.
That's correct.
So every dollar, if you get a $300 a month award, the state is going to be getting a $1,500 check. So why
best
even
interest,
take,
best interest of the child is double speak. Yeah, it's double speak for best interest of the state. That's what they're really
exactly.
mean. That's what they're really saying.
Yeah. I'm going to invite you two guys to stay over and listen to this breakthrough study. I had a couple of people ask me about it, and I'm going to play it. It's in two parts. It's about 14 minutes long, but this guy, he's retired and he used to work in government, in the economy, and he did this study for the University of California talking about how it's totally calculated wrong, and the government knows this. They know it, but they refuse to change it. So we're going to play that.
All right, I appreciate the opportunity to speak, and I'm going to sign off a little early, and again, I appreciate it.
Okay,
I'll get back to you on that affidavit.
Yeah, and you're always welcome on the show. If you want to bring some new information in, you can always
hope I get to bring a victory in federal court back on the air. That would be nice.
That would be super awesome to break the news on this show and go in and just break it down how we would celebrate. We'll celebrate live online.
We will definitely celebrate.
Okay.
Thanks again. I appreciate it. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Any
listeners out there, I'm going to play this, and we'll be back. So the lines are still open, so feel free to call in. I'm going to play this first one. It's 8 minutes long. I'll be back on the other side of this break. Hope you stay with us, Roger. Okay, if not, I'll definitely be checking you tomorrow. Okay, we're going to take a break, and I'll be right back on the other side of this break.
Hi, I'm Joe Sorge, and I'd like to tell you about a breakthrough study coming out of the University of California that reveals some shocking facts related to our child support system. We all know that divorce is contentious, but why the long, drawn-out battles over custody? These battles pit one parent against the other and put the children in the middle. In most cases, both parents want to see their children, and except under rare circumstances, do the children not want to see both parents. So why don't the parents simply share the children? Well, you guessed it, money. If child support levels are set too low, the children may not get proper housing or food or clothing. But if child support levels are set too high, the payer may not be able to afford the payments. And under our current system, if a payer falls behind on payments, a warrant may be issued for their arrest. And if they're arrested, their driver's licenses are taken away and they're put in jail, where they can't work and make money to catch up on their payments. So it's a vicious cycle and nobody wins. We believe that this University of California study reveals for the first time the true costs of raising children and uncovers damning evidence that our current child support calculations unnecessarily fuel custody battles. So we sat down with a brilliant economist, Dr. William Komenarth, the main author of this study. He's professor of economics at the University of California and once served as the chief economist of the Federal Trade Commission in Washington, D.C. Thanks for giving us the opportunity to do this.
I'm delighted.
So if it costs $500 a month to raise a child in the state of Alabama, does every parent pay $500 a month?
No, the state can set different amounts for wealthier parents than poorer parents, can set different amounts if there's two children or three children as opposed to one child in the household. So the states have lots of flexibility. But however they do it, they must pay attention to available data on the economic cost of raising children.
Can an economist determine what it costs to raise a child?
Yes. Suppose you have two households with pretty much the same income levels and the same general standards of living. And one of these households might have one child, and another household might be childless. And then one can compare the household with a child with the household without the child, and try to examine with available data, did the household with the child spend more on housing, more on food, more on clothing, more on childcare and education, more on other different elements of expenditures. Suppose it's true that a household is composed of a husband and a wife and no children, and they live in a two-bedroom apartment, and they use the second bedroom as a den. Now suppose a child arrives, and the den is transformed into a nursery. Let's compare the two circumstances. Well, given my hypothetical example, notice there is no change in housing costs. They spent the same amount on rent when the child arrives as they spent originally. They stay in the same unit. For the most part, your child lives in your household and, you know, consumes the same collection of goods that you consume.
Do people that have their first child spend more on food?
Generally, no. They spend the same amount on food despite the presence of the first child than they spend earlier.
If you have another mouth eating, how could you possibly not spend more on food?
You probably throw away less. Suppose it was true before the presence of children, you would eat out a lot. And we all know that food in restaurants is expensive. And when the child arrives, you eat at home more. So there may be some redistribution within the categories. I don't doubt that. But your total outlays, you know, don't appear to be that much different in the presence of a child than before.
Dr. Kommener's approach measures what is typically called marginal cost increases. For example, an automobile does not burn much more gasoline with two people sitting in it than it does with just one person sitting in it. The cost of the extra fuel consumed would be called the marginal cost of adding a second passenger. If we dig into the details of Dr. Kommener's publication, we find that the increase in food expense is, in fact, very low when children are young. But as the children age, food costs go up significantly. This might lead one to believe that child support amounts should be increased as the children age. However, Dr. Kommener's data also reveal a counterbalancing trend. Parents spend less on child care services as the children age. While these two factors do not offset each other exactly, and the results vary somewhat in different economic brackets, total marginal expenses do not change substantially as children get older. How many households did you study?
We looked at over 16,000 households to do these comparisons.
Your control group had no children?
That's correct.
And then the group that you were measuring the increase in expenditures had one, two, three, or more children?
We did it in three different circumstances, with one child, with two children, and with three children.
I asked Dr. Kommener if others had published on this topic before he and his co-authors did. He said yes, there are two other published methods, but neither looks at out-of-pocket marginal costs.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture annually publishes a report on the cost of raising children. And what's striking is that they use the same data that I use. We all use the same data.
But he said that the USDA method is flawed because it simply takes certain expenditure categories and divides those costs by the number of individuals in the family, including the children. This is called the average costs method as opposed to the out-of-pocket marginal costs method. I asked him to give us an example of why his method comes up with a more realistic measure of transportation costs than the USDA method.
The household had two cars before the arrival of children and now has two cars still. And for the most part, they spend the same amount of money on cars and gasoline and all of that stuff. And the cars had a back seat before, which wasn't generally used. And now it's used with the child. So there's essentially no additional transportation cost. The real transportation cost is the cost of the car seat.
He went on to explain that the USDA method is also flawed with respect to housing costs.
They said that the housing cost of the child is the cost of an additional bedroom. So if originally you had a two-bedroom apartment, one used for the den, then the housing cost would be the hypothetical rental cost of a three-bedroom apartment where you could keep your den even if that was never used. So again, that was a fiction.
We then talked about a second competing method for studying the costs of raising children, called the income equivalence, or IE method. The IE method is used by a private consulting firm that advises many of the states regarding child support levels.
They measure the welfare of a household in terms of the proportion spent on alternatively food or...
Okay, we're back. That was part one of a breakthrough study. Roger, what did you think about that?
Oh, Carl, it was very hard to hear what that person was saying. I'm sorry.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I was just asking what you thought about that, how they're calculating these child support payments and how it's impacting families.
Again, I think it's totally structured wrong. Again, almost to me, it goes against the Brown Act.
Yes, it does. And what we're out here doing on the Child Support Hustle Show, we're trying to wake more people up. And I was glad to have Greg Parsons on, who is an advocate for disabled veterans, talking about how they can get their due process civil rights when it comes to their child support obligations. And we'll be featuring him on HuntsvilleBlack.com, him and his affidavit, in here the next few days. Before I go into this second part, you want to say a little bit about what people can expect tomorrow on tomorrow's show? I know y'all got a show going on with Sherry and Deanna. I always listen in.
Yes, on their show, I'm going to be bringing up the starting of our Cannabis Reform Minority Party and the biggest issues on decriminalization versus legalization. I will also bring up the fact that we are starting the Compassionate Care Center for our cities to become a part of our cities.
That sounds very interesting.
But again, back to having a party that has a structure of rules that we follow, a general plan that the rest of the people know what we're following, we don't have yet.
Yes, and that will be it's going to be very interesting tomorrow. So I want to let all my listeners of the Child Support Hustle Show to try to tune in tomorrow at the same time, about 5 o'clock, as they will be discussing some very important issues that very well, it impacts a lot of the veterans too. I was glad to see the Senate pass the last bill they just passed concerning medical cannabis and allowing veterans access to it, but we need full access for the American people, and that will cover all veterans and everyone else. And I hope to have Peter Collins on my show. I'm going to reach out to Peter Collins. We did an article on Peter Collins, and he was a veteran. He had 6 combat missions. And what happened to him was just a disgrace in Alabama. Are you familiar with Peter Collins?
Not too much, no, I'm not. But I've heard a lot of our vets have come back and been discriminated against their state by using cannabis.
Yeah, Peter Collins, he was one of those veterans. He came back, and he was suffering from post-traumatic before he even came back. The government knew it. The military knew it. And so he had 2 degrees from UAB. One in biology. So he was growing his own in Blount County, and he wasn't selling to anybody. He was using it. He knew specific strains with hemp, his post-traumatic. So he did research, found out which strains, and he started self-medicating himself with that because he did not trust the VA and the medications that they give. Well, when the word got out, he wasn't selling, but the word got out that he was growing some, and they came in, raided his farm, took all his vehicles, 2 of which he bought when he was serving in Iraq and Afghanistan. They took all that, took all his benefits. They took everything from him. He couldn't even get food stamps, although he had served his country for most of his adult life, about 21 years, and the first time he ever needed help, he was denied. But yet, they still will give food stamps and food stamp benefits to child molesters. But this man couldn't even get that. And so they just basically almost destroyed his life, and he's getting it back together. He's fighting back, and he's had some good things happen to him lately, and he's just fighting to get what he earned, and all because of a plant. They would even destroy someone who defended this country. It's an insult.
I've had the same thing happen to me. The federal came in and stole everything away and stripped me from my rights that I was trying to do to help the people. And it's people like him we need to reach out and regroup and feel strong about what we've done and not feel ashamed at all. But again, the people will start following us and we show our braveness of what we've done already.
You said, I like what you said, excuse me, I like what you said just then, because part of the Child Support Hustle Show too is we're encouraging people to come out, and they put this stigma on you with these charges and with trying to take everything you got. You can't, I know you want to go run and hide in the corner, but once they come after you like that, or once they're not giving you your full rights like the cannabis or letting you get the benefits that you earned, you have got to come out. You got to be bold and speak out. And that's the only way. That's the only thing they fear is when we wake up and band together and talk about these issues. They look to shame you off into a corner where you will not speak out. We need everybody speaking out about what's happened with these veterans and about a full right to cannabis. We need full rights to cannabis.
Yes, and again, I'm sure there's a few of us out there that feel the same as I do. We're here for them. If we have to go underneath the table, so be it. We're still going to help our vets.
Yeah, okay, before I play this part two of this today, Roger, could you give the listeners any kind of way, because some might not be able to listen tomorrow, how they can reach you and your organization? Could you give them some information where they can contact you?
Yes, I've gone under a simple Facebook name. It's just using my name, Roger Southfield, at gmail.com. Again, it's the number 12 at gmail.com is my Gmail. But again, please, everybody reach out to me, and I will reach out to them, because it's time for us to unite our knowledge together how to make this thing work.
Yes, it is, and we're going to do that, too. We're going to free the plant. We're going to free the plant, people. And I'll be back to close the show right after part two, 7 minutes.
Yeah, again, if everybody goes to my website.
Whether or not in the presence of the child you spent less on adult clothing or food than you did otherwise.
Sound complicated? Well, that's because it is. Let us try to explain the convoluted approach taken by the IE method. The IE method assumes that fewer dollars are spent on adult food and adult clothing so that money could be made available for the needs of the children. The method then assumes that a similar shifting of expenses will occur in other cost categories as well, such as for transportation and housing costs. But the IE method does not measure those shifting expenses directly. Instead, it makes the questionable assumption that parents will give up the same proportion or percentage of their income in other expense categories as they did for adult food and clothing. So it multiplies that same percentage times the family's other expenses to compute a synthetic amount. It then assumes that a custodial parent would need this synthetic amount in order to raise children under a lifestyle that also affords that custodial parent all the things they enjoyed prior to having children.
They're trying to assign a value to keeping the old lifestyle, even though you're living with a child and you don't follow the old lifestyle.
You may not even want the old lifestyle.
And you may not even want, that's exactly right, you may not even want the old lifestyle, but that's not taken into account in these other methods. It's a bizarre approach, I believe.
I asked Dr. Komenor for some examples of what types of hypothetical reductions in the standard of living might be computed in the IE method's synthetic amount.
Food costs are largely, or often, restaurant meals out. And some people want to have very high fashion clothing and some do not. We all know that once you have a child, your whole life changes. And you have focus on your children in a way that you never did before. But the methodology used in this IE method ignores that reality.
Does the IE method measure the value to parents of having a child?
No, it doesn't.
I've read that some of these IE methods actually measure the amount of tobacco and alcohol consumed by the adults.
Yes, they do. Isn't that bizarre? And yet, that approach is the dominant approach used today by which child support guideline amounts are determined.
Why?
The reason is because when the states got into this business back in the 1980s, there was no data on the child expenditures, there were data on household expenditures. And so they needed to find a way to go from available data for the household to that which it applies to the child.
Did the IE method look at single parents with children?
No, they did not. They only looked at married households.
What about the USDA method? Did they look at single parents?
Yes, they did. They did look at single parents as well as married parents.
And did you look at single parents?
Yes, I did.
Because one could argue that the single parent with a child is the more relevant economic situation than the married or the couple with or without children.
That's exactly right. The costs of raising a child or children in a single-headed household are slightly greater than on average than those in a married household.
you're basically saying that people spend less on children than these other methods estimate they spend on children.
Yes, substantially less. And the reason is because our method is limited to out-of-pocket expenditures. You know, direct
real money.
Real money. What the other methods do is attribute expenditures to children which are not made out of pocket. It's a fiction.
Well, let's take a look at the costs estimated by the IE and USDA methods and compare them to the costs measured by Dr. Komenor's method. For married households, the IE method overestimated the cost of raising a child by about 200%, and the USDA method overestimated the cost by roughly 300%. The overestimates were even more extreme for single-parent households. While the IE method did not even look at single-parent households, the USDA method overestimated expenses by over 300% for low-income households and over 400% for mid- to high-income households. These overestimates have been misleading the states into setting child support awards that are too high, by somewhere between $400 and $800 per month per child. Over the course of a child's dependency, that could amount to nearly $100,000 per child of unsupported costs for low-income families and nearly $200,000 per child of unsupported costs for middle-income families. This begs the question of whether the $120 billion of unpaid child support in the United States today is due to parents' unwillingness to make child support payments, or are the amounts so high that they cannot afford to make them. Essentially, there is a profit in being a custodial parent.
That's exactly right. That's what the current child support system does.
Do you think that this profit factor that exists in the guidelines now can cause non-optimal behavior?
For the child support system to work effectively, it must have the agreement of both parents, not only the recipient, but the payer. And the payers recognize that the amount of money that they are obligated to pay exceeds actual expenditures on the child, they know that. They're not saying they live it. And so what the payers are funding is not merely the cost of raising their children, but also a financial asset which benefits the recipient. And of course that creates discord between the parents. The payer objects and the recipient feels entitled to it, which would not be true if the child support award amounts truly reflected the out-of-pocket costs of raising children.
And is there a venue where this discord gets played out?
In the courts. In divorce courts.
This is one of the most contentious areas of family law, and the unfortunate truth is that children are paying the price for a flawed system. If you would like to see your state review its child support guidelines, please contact your state legislators and let them know that children should not be used as pawns in an economic battle involving their parents and their lawyers. I hope that with your help, we can work toward reducing the conflicts inherent in our family court system. I'm Joe Sorge. Thank you for watching.
Okay, we're back, folks. That was part two of a breakthrough study when it comes to calculating child support. And with that, if you want to say anything else, Roger, before we sign off?
No, again, I'm just looking forward to show tomorrow. And again, I hope I could be very informative to everybody that we can get more people to respond.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, because we're on a good track here. You know, we got the pot going and people are listening. We're stirring the pot. We're getting people woke up and talking about it because there really is a need to just free the total plant. And Roger, Deanna, and Sherry are going to have a great show tomorrow, so I invite everybody to tune back in and check us out tomorrow, Bringing the Voices Power Network with United Voices.
Yes, I want to thank United Voices and Block Talk Radio for their exposure.
Police. Cheaper.